way that I speak and I like the things that I like. And then I would go to like aftercare school, and things would like, I was like everybody's favorite. So I was really confused a lot growing up, and what all these different environments taught me was that all I needed to do was to be able to blend in wherever I was and I would be okay. And so I started this very strenuous journey of building a personality for each environment and compartmentalizing each environment and my friends and things of that nature. So I found out very young that I was really good at sports. Apparently Black people have extra muscle in their calf, which makes us incredibly athletic or something like that, they say. I was really good at sports, and I was really, really good at theater as well. And so I did both of those things throughout school. The father figure I ended up having, who I became very grateful for, was my Uncle Troy. I have two twin cousins, Trish and Shay, and they have an older brother, Adam. And we spent a lot of time with their family. They two played basketball, and so we would all play these like big games where we would elbow each other in the face and shit. And somebody always left bleeding. That's what I remember. It was awesome, though. Those were some of my best memories. But my Uncle Troy was like, he was like my father figure and like my best friend. I remember when I was 6 years old, and I've always been terrified of roller coasters, so I still don't understand why I even have this story. But for my birthday, when I was 6 years old, we went to Six Flags. And I'm like terrified of heights. So it's like, why would you take a 6 year old to a fucking amusement park? But I remember everybody was just having so much fun, like riding these rides. And my Uncle Troy, fortunately, was scared of roller coasters too. I don't know if he was or if he was just saying that to make me feel more comfortable. But so he sat there with me all day. And I remember that, and I was very grateful for that for him. But I was always in sports, and I was always in theater. And so that's where I really started to build my identity, because, you know, that's where I like received praise and attention, which are two other things that I've noticed that I was also addicted to. I remember, I think it was when I was 13, is when I started noticing, now in hindsight, some of the addictive behaviors. My drug of no choice was methamphetamines. And so, as you can imagine, I'm a very tired person now at 19 months sober, you know, still trying to catch up on sleep. I remember when I was like 13, I would stay up for like days at a time, like 3 or 4 days in a row, with Mountain Dew and like Cheez-Its and a fucking video game. And I wouldn't shower, and I would pee in a bottle so I didn't have to leave the room. Like it was really like intense, like behavior for like a, you know, like a 13-year-old kid. And didn't know that I would get to doing that later on in life either, but I did. And so that's where I really started to notice some of the behaviors. Was when I was 13, I started lying a lot more to my parents. I started like trying to manipulate. That was right about the time that my stepdad came around. So I would try and manipulate, like turning my parents against each other and stuff like that. So a lot of those addict behaviors really started to show up around that age. And so a few years later was my first time ever putting a substance into my body. It was marijuana, or marijuana weed. So I remember, it was my friend down the street. His name was Chris Donaldson. And, I remember he was like, "Hey man, you got to come over after school. Like, found my stepdad's weed stash. Like, we're going to smoke some, man." I was like, "Oh yeah, bro. Like, I love weed." And it's like, no, I don't. I didn't even know what the fuck weed was until he just said something about it. I went with him and we smoked some weed, some Reggie for all you old heads out there and know what I'm talking about, stems and seeds. I remember like it was fucking terrible. Like I hated it. Like it was like the worst experience of my life, man. I was like all lightheaded, and I was like all of a sudden hungry, you know, and I just I couldn't, like, it was an insatiable appetite. Like, I literally ate, like, 4 sandwiches and, like, 6 bowls of ramen. My mom got home and was like, what the fuck is going on? You know, like, everybody's confused. Like, it was terrible. But the reason it's important is because I remember, like, thinking to myself as I laid in my bed, like, dizzy, and after eating so much food, like I feel miserable. And I remember thinking to myself, like, man, I am never doing that shit again. Like, ever. It was the worst experience of my life. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen. And so the next day, I was a very avid ramen noodle maker growing up because we grew up poor. So I can still show you 100 different ways to make ramen noodles, and they all taste different. It can be the same flavor, but I'll make them taste different. I'll break out some spices. But I would make ramen every day after school. It was my after school snack. And so on this particular day, I went into the cabinet to get the spices, and I noticed two things that I really hadn't noticed before. It was oregano and bay leaves. They were right next to each other. And I remember thinking to myself, like, man, that kind of looks like that weed shit from yesterday. And so I grabbed some, and I poured it in notebook paper, and I tried to go out back and smoke the notebook paper. So there's the big red flag that I was probably set to be a drug addict. Because, you know, just the very day before, I was like, man, I'm never doing this again. And here I am in the backyard with fucking oregano and bay leaves, you know, trying to get high. And so that was my first experience with putting a substance in my body. It was like, you know, from the moment in hindsight, from the moment I put a substance in my body, like it was very certain to me that I was a drug addict. And so soon after that, we moved to a completely different city and state. And so a little backstory, like, we moved a lot when I was a kid. We moved around a lot. So I went to like 5 different schools. So we moved to Austin, Texas. I remember feeling angry and like scared. And really unsure of how I was going to fit in with these people, with the way my school environment was in Kansas City. And so so I just tried to make some friends. I heard about a party, like, passing someone else in the hallway, and I asked him about it. I was like, hey, where's the party at? Like a little fucking nerd or whatever, a loser. And they told me where the party was, and so I went, and I met a few gentlemen who became like brothers to me. It was Marshall, DJ, and Justin. And man, me and those guys went through some stuff. That was actually the group of friends that introduced me to methamphetamines just a few years later. But yeah, I met them, and I started partying, and I realized that since I was good at basketball, like, I guess I was also good at beer pong, and I was. So that was cool. I partied and partied and partied and got a basketball scholarship to college and partied and partied and partied. And they asked me to leave 3 months later. My drinking and my using was always out of control. Like, there was never any like semblance of control where I can look back and be like, but I did it, you know, at this period in my life. Like, if there was, it was like maybe for like a week, you know. When I got back from college, like, my mom got me this job, like a really good job at a foreclosure bank or at a mortgage bank as a foreclosure specialist. I was making like $20 an hour and I'm 19 years old. And there was like a room for growth. Like, they were trying to fast track me to like a VP or some shit like that. You know, I was there for like a year. I was living with my parents for most of that year, so I didn't really do a lot of drugs and stuff like that. Once I got my own place though, 3 days before I made it to a year working at this place, I got my own place, and I moved into my own place. And by the time I hit a year, I was fired. I was at my own place for 3 days. And I partied all 3 days, and I went to work one of those 3 days. And so they fired me. And so really what it looks like, man, is like, you know, getting arrested, getting out, or, you know, getting kicked out of somebody's house whose couch I was sleeping on. There's always like a situation, and then I would be like, oh man, I'm going to get sober now. And I would for like, you know, a few days, and I'm like, you know, maybe that was a rash decision. You know, the decision to get sober was just a rash decision, an impulse decision. It wasn't the right one. And so that's what it looked like. The cycle of just like, you know, partying, getting tired, you know, getting sober, and then, you know, going back to it. So yeah, they introduced me to methamphetamines, and I was 20 years old. So 2010, is when I started doing that. And I remember the first time I did it, man, it was just like I knew that everything was right in the world. If that makes sense. It was like when I exhaled, I finally felt like the person that I always wanted to be. And I remember that feeling, and I chased that feeling because I've done it probably millions of times since then. And I never had that feeling again. That I got that first time. But yeah, man, it was a lot of the same thing. Once I started doing meth, man, just that cycle. In 2013, my precious daughter, who will be 7 years old in a couple of weeks, she was born, May 18th, 2013. And, I remember the first memory that I have with her is holding her, and I was high. Because I couldn't, you know, a lot of what my story looks like, of what it was like was I could not not get high anymore. Like it was like the point of no return had been crossed long ago. You know, I was with my daughter for like a few weeks, and then, you know, I couldn't take it anymore. Like I had to go get high. And so I left to go get high, and I just didn't come back. You know, she was with her mom, so she was fine in my book. She didn't need me. She had a lot of family. And in September of 2013, I got arrested in Williamson County with a couple of ounces of meth, a bunch of paraphernalia, some fake money, like $1,800 in like fake money, and just like it was a bad situation. You really just don't want to get arrested. But you really don't want to get arrested in Williamson County. I'm just saying, like, just go get arrested somewhere else if you decide you know, still want to do that. But yeah, so by the grace of God, I was put on deferred adjudication for 5 years. That was in 2013, and I'm still on deferred adjudication. So if you can do math, you will see that that is 7 years, and I'm very bad at completing things in a timely fashion. So I got extended. But yeah, so even the arrest, man, it was like I need to stop, and I didn't quite stop. You know, I stopped for a while, just smoked weed, and then I made it back to it. And then I got possession of my daughter in 2014, and that didn't stop me. You know, I was trying to balance parenting and a meth addiction, and I thought I was doing such a bang up job, and I really was not. And so, that year, was the year also that, DJ was murdered. He was calling my phone over and over and over. And it was one of the, I just got back from a run. I was with my daughter and I was so tired. And I was like, man, I just don't want to deal with his shit today. And so I didn't answer. And I got a call a couple hours later that he was dead. And he had stolen a car because he couldn't find anybody to come pick him up. One of the things that always keeps me, in a place of sickness, even sometimes today in recovery, are the feelings of shame, right? You know, guilt is like me, my guilt is healthy. It's like I did something and I feel bad about it. Shame is like when I take that thing that I did and I make it like my character, it's like I am bad because of this. And so feelings of shame, like, kind of sent me on this spiral, until finally, you know, I remembered him always talking about Austin recovery. And so, I hit this place where I was like, man, let me call him. And, I called him and they got me in, and I rode over to the ranch the first time with good old Taylor Hodkin. Y'all know her, y'all know and love her so well. We rode over together to rehab, and you know, it's pretty crazy when you make when you pass judgments. And I know people do this. They're like, they're sitting in treatment and they're like, man, that guy is gonna stay sober, but that motherfucker over there, no chance, right? And so when you were looking at me and Taylor next to each other, like, she was like fucking out of control, dude. And I was just like, yeah, you know. So it's like, if you would have guessed, man, you'd have been like, man, that dude's gonna make it, and she is definitely not done. And she's been sober this entire time, and here I am finally telling my story, you know, at 19 months sober, you know, 5 years later. But yeah, so I stayed sober for about 30 minutes after I got out of Austin Recovery the first time. I made it back to the house, and I was putting my stuff away in the closet, and I found a can of air duster, and I huffed the entire thing, and then I passed out, and I probably peed on myself. I don't remember, but yeah, I made it about 30 minutes, and so then started the rehab cycle, right? So I would go to rehab, and I would, you know, do good for a little while because I had to, because probation was about to send me to prison. So I had to go to rehab, you know, and then I would go back to right back to what I was doing. I guess the only silver lining with rehab is I always stayed sober a little longer each time I got sober. So it was like 30 seconds, and then I stayed sober for like a week, and then I went to rehab and I stayed sober for like 30 days, and you know, always stayed sober a little bit longer, but yeah, so I did that cycle, of in and out of rehabs, until this last time, is when it really started to hit home. I was, working on Waco for Oxford House, and, I relapsed out there and made it back to the city. And for the first time, in my drug use, I made it to, meth psychosis. If you're not familiar with what that is, you should be very grateful. It is fucking terrifying. I remember thinking that everybody was against me. They were trying to get me to do something or to learn something, and I couldn't figure out what the fuck it was. And I kept thinking I figured it out, and I would just yell at random people at the gas stations like, oh, that's what you're trying to get me to figure out? I got it. Thank you. Y'all can leave me alone now. And I'm just like, walk off. But then like everybody was still doing the thing. And it was a scary place to be, man. And, one thing I was always able to do though was call my mom and be like, mom, you know, I'm ready to quit. Like I'm done. And she would bring me back in. And this time, I called her and I was like, mom, like, and I had my girlfriend why I had a girlfriend at the time. Like, I don't know why this girl's dating me. Like, I'm in psychosis. But anyway, she's sitting in the car next to me, and I'm on the phone with my mom, and I'm like, mom, they're trying to kill me. And she's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I was like, she's sitting right next to me. I can't talk too loud. She's like, and then she's like, I can hear you. And I'm like, oh, she can hear me. You know, like, it's like, it is literally like insane. But my mom did something that she had never done before. She said, you can't come here. And she hung up on me. You know, it talks about in the big book, that place, in Bill's story where he gets to, the loneliness and the bitter morass, right? That like I had never felt more alone and more empty, at any point in my life than in that moment. And so I did, after I threw a tantrum and she hopped out of the car and I threw my phone because it was bugged. I went to NA24. That was the place that was close. It was almost 5:30. And so, you know, I was like, man, you know what? Like these people are in AA. They can't be a part of the conspiracy. Right. So I went there, and then wouldn't you know, like, you know, and this happens to me sometimes in sobriety at this point in my life too. It's like, sometimes like I'll be going through something and then I'll go to a meeting and it's like, everybody is sharing at me, you know, it's like, they know what I'm going through. And like every share is like, oh bro, like do they know, you know? Yeah, man, I felt like super like attacked by what everybody was saying. It's not like they were saying like anything bad. Like they were, you know, they were saying all positive things, but yeah, I took, by going to that meeting, you know, like that was like a different action, right? Because like what always had to happen before was I had to be separated. Like I had to go to rehab or else I wouldn't quit. And this time I just went to a meeting. There was no separation from the drugs. I was still in the world. And that was the first time I just like taken a decision without like being prompted, you know, by probation or by a parent or by somebody. Like it was just like, you know what, this is the only place I can go, so this is where I'm gonna go. And so I went there, I went to the meeting, I got some numbers after. I called some people in recovery and I ended up at this Oxford House in Austin that I lived at for a while before I went to work, in Waco. And everybody was happy to see me, you know, there's like, oh, Robert's back. I'm like, you know, everybody's, you know, people are coming over. My best friend Samara, she came over, and I remember me and her were like sitting at this table and everybody's here and like having these loud conversations and laughing and joking. And I remember like I still had a meth pipe in underneath my seat and it was full because I was going there to get some sleep. And then I was going to wake up tomorrow and the voices and the psychosis would be gone. So I was just going to smoke some more meth. Like I was just going to go back to what I was doing. That was my plan, was to just get some sleep and then go back to what I was doing. Samara was just looking at me and I felt her looking at me. I looked over at her. I'm like, what? She's like, are you fucking done or not? And, I had to pause for a second, you know, because like I was at this crossroad where it was like, where I can start to get honest, or I can continue like, you know, this lie that I've been living and just go back to what I was doing. And so, I told her, yeah. And I slid the keys across the table. I said, there's a fully loaded meth pipe underneath my seat. And, they broke it. And, man, that really started like, the amount of gratitude that I have for this journey, like this bout of sobriety, like I said I wasn't gonna cry, but it's like astounding, man. I got sober on an Oxford House couch with a bunch of guys who loved the shit out of me while I was in psychosis still for like another 2 weeks, completely sober. And by all like all rights and means, I shouldn't be here. I've done some very dangerous things for and around methamphetamine and other drugs. There's like a heroin stage and stuff in there. And to have some people love me the way that they did, even in the state that I was in, was like huge for me. And it was exactly what I needed. So yeah, man, I was very solid in my first step, like, you know, powerlessness, unmanageability, like, duh, you know, duh. And then from my other bouts of sobriety, I started to understand what people were talking about when they were talking about the unmanageability aspect, because that still shows up in recovery too. You know, how I don't have the ability to make like, great decisions. I just don't make good decisions. I started doing these steps. You know, my first sponsor was David, who's, is he an alumni? No, Kyle's an alumni. His wife is an alumni, but, he was my first, sponsor on this go around and we went through up until step four and then I switched sponsors. And then I don't remember which sponsor that was, but I stayed with them up until step four. And then I switched sponsors. And I'm telling you this, not so that you can do the same thing, but so that you don't do this. Because that was my cycle, right? I would always get a sponsor and then I would get up to step four and then I would just get a new one. So I didn't want to do it. And so finally I got to a sponsor who I tried to leave on step four. He would not let me. And thank God he did not let me. Because I had a woman who I was very, very close to overdose in April of last year. And I was in the middle of doing inventory and one very important name I had left off that list and it was God. And because of that situation, like I was encouraged to put God down and I got to really see some truth about like what was blocking me from like actually taking steps towards, getting connected to and building a relationship with this higher power that's necessary, right? I got to really shine some light on those areas and really grow through that. And then my fifth step with that same individual was just like a beautiful experience where I just got to like unload some stuff that like I had just been really kind of sitting on. And I had done a fourth and fifth step before, but it was just kind of like, yeah, I'm just doing this because, you know, it's what I'm supposed to do, right? The difference this round of sobriety is that everything that I do in my recovery, I do with the intention of connecting and growing and understanding this relationship with my higher power. My experience is if you do the work just for the sake of doing the work and don't do it with that intention, then I don't gain the benefits that are necessary in order for me to like sustain this thing. And that's what my 20 plus bouts of sobriety have shown me. But yeah, man, I guess my life today. So my family moved about six months ago now. My entire family moved back to Kansas City. And one thing that I had always ignored in all my other bouts of sobriety was my mental health. I just like kind of pushed it to the side and like acted like it wasn't there. And I think my family moving really helped open the door to like exposing how bad it was. And I remember I have a different sponsor now, Bobby W. If y'all know Robert W. He's my sponsor now. We were sitting there having a conversation about somebody, and he was like, "Oh man, that dude's a great dude. He just can't stay sober because he won't acknowledge his mental health." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah, man, if the dude would just acknowledge his mental health and take care of it, I'm sure the dude has the capacity to be honest, but he's mentally not right. He can't do it." And I was like, "Holy shit, man. Like, there's, there's a lot of validity to that statement." And it wasn't even about me, you know? And so I really started to, I was kind of forced into a place to where I needed to look at it. The depression got really bad and I started, having really wayward, decision-making processes and thoughts and ideations. And, you know, there was one day where, I was very sure, of what I was going to do, had a plan. And, by the grace of God, my supervisor that man can spot bullshit like blocks away. I can tell you, cause I'm bouncing around my job and I'm like high fiving and I'm like, "Ooh, y'all know how I do. Like y'all see it, right?" I'm just being totally myself. And my supervisor was like, "What the hell is wrong with you?" And I was like, "What are you talking about? Like nothing's wrong with me." But there was, and not only did he make me go home, but he took me to the doctor and he sat with me while we waited to talk to him. And I'm very, very grateful for people like that today. Yeah, borderline personality disorder, and some depression issues. And here we are a few months later, with the right medication and like some therapy and like things are really starting to, turn around for me. But it's like, you know, acknowledging this and like doing something about it has probably been the most important thing that I've done for my recovery. Because like I said, man, it was like, you know, I was always stuck in this cycle of going in, going back out, going in, going back out. And I remember, you know, the first time my doctor asked me like what was going on, I said, you know, my response is really simple. It's like every day that I wake up and I open my eyes, the first thing I say is fuck, woke up again, you know? And that's not normal. It's really not normal. I was able to acknowledge some of those things and get that squared away. And now I'm at a good place, man, where it's like, I'm starting to feel with like true happiness and like joy and peace feels like, it's pretty cool. I work in recovery, which is, whoo, let me tell you, it's an experience within itself. I work in recovery. I'm very grateful for it. I work at Infinite. I'm the Chris Gates of Infinite Recovery. I'm the alumni coordinator. So, now that he's had some time, I'm going to be picking that brain, Chris. I get to travel for softball. I play like in Texas. I was supposed to go to Vegas this year, but it unfortunately got canceled due to Corona. But whenever Palm Springs opens up, I'm going to go later this year. So I get to travel, which is weird because I'm on probation. My probation officer just really doesn't care where I go as long as the word sober is attached to the event. So sober softball, boom, in there. today I have a great relationship with my family. So good, in fact, that I'm still very behind on my probation payments. And so I would get extended another 2 years if I made it to the end of this year and hadn't paid it off. It's like $3,900. I don't make enough money to pay everything that I pay and still pay that off too by the end of the year. So I called my mom and my uncle for help. And the response I got was like, not what I expected. My uncle said, well, I hate loan places. I would never help you do that. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Well, I figured the answer would be no anyway. He's like, but let me scrape together the funds. I'll give you the money. What? Like, these are people who didn't want me to come for Thanksgiving because they were worried about me stealing shit, just a few years ago. And today they trust me, which is pretty cool, man. I live in a house with some roommates. My roommate's over here. Hi, Jeff. You want to stick your hand in there? He's over here listening. I have some sober roommates that I live with. They're pretty cool. We hold each other accountable on a very minimal level. I'm not going to act like we're just running around here like, what does your program look like? But when it gets serious enough, we do talk to each other about it. And I'm very grateful for those guys. I think the most important gift that I've gotten from this program is like I said, man, it's like peace and like this understanding that I am not a mistake. I make mistakes, but I'm not one. Like I can love and I am lovable. Statements like that were not statements that hung around my mind very often. Is actually the opposite. And by taking root in like this program and like working my steps and like staying connected to the fellowship and like, you know, staying with my sponsor, like doing H9s, like everything that they're supposed to do, God has given me the space to be able to venture out and do these other things, like look at codependency, look at mental health, things like that. And so I get to round myself out as a person, man, and I'm super grateful. And I feel like I missed some stuff and like skipped some stuff. And I know Tommy's down there, Mama Tommy. Like, there's a whole I could have told y'all 45 minutes about my experience of living with Tommy. Like, it was whew. But I love you. Thank you so much. I'm so sorry I put you through it. But yeah, man, I'm super grateful for all of y'all for listening. You know, a lot of y'all have been a big part of this journey for me, like big part of this in and out cycle. And like, I guarantee you, you know, with the way that like I said, the way that my mental health is, like, it's been very bad for a very long time. And I guarantee that everybody that's on this screen, that I know personally has said something at one point or another that has saved my life. And I thank you for that. I truly do. I'm going to not cry. And, that's all I got. Thank y'all for letting me share.
Robert. Yeah.